Mais le contenu.
Yes, we this morning's meeting is just to receive a briefing on the Code of Good Administrative Conduct in terms of Promotion of Administrative Justice Act. As I understand it, this is our opportunity, if we deem it necessary, to put forward proposals and amendments, because when the minister tables it, that's it. The opportunity will have been lost. So, with that in mind, Mr. Rudman.
Can I just ask, through you, Chair, to Mr. Rudman, was good administrative conduct followed in drafting this code? Yes.
Absolutely, and I will try to explain. Chair, thank you very much, and good morning to you and to the members. Chair, I will just give you some background on the code, where it comes from, and what the processes were up to now, and then Ina will deal with the contents of the code. The code is made by the Minister of Justice and Constitutional Development in terms of Section 10.5A of the PAJA Act. The code must be approved by Cabinet and also by Parliament. And it was after approval by Cabinet in 2008, the code was tabled in both Houses of Parliament for consideration by Parliament. It was not dealt with at that stage due to time constraints by the then Parliament, and it was then resubmitted to Parliament on the 27th of August 2009, and subsequently in November, Chair, we briefed the Portfolio Committee on the contents of the code. Now, one of the researchers at that stage made some comments, I think it was Christine, some comments on the code, and those comments were considered by the then Portfolio Committee, and she raised two concerns, namely, firstly, that the rules that were made by the Rules Board at that stage were not contained in the code itself, and also that the code contained a few outdated references. It contained those references because of the delay that transpired after tabling of the code in Parliament. Chair, I must just say that at that stage, the committee really did not consider the contents of the code itself. The committee concentrated on the document of the researcher, discussed the suggestions that were made, but the committee did not consider the code. And as you know, the committee, and as you indicated earlier, the committee cannot amend the code. And that is why we then decided that we should submit a redrafted version of the code addressing the concerns raised by the researcher, and also containing a number of other amendments to the code that resulted from further consultation that we had and further research that we had. And we decided that we will request the committee through the minister whether the committee would be prepared to consider the code on an informal basis at this stage, so that when we then go back to Cabinet, which we will probably have to do, when we go back to Cabinet, we can indicate that the committee has agreed to the code, and when we table the code, it would then be a code that has the approval of the committee itself. Chair, I must also just deal with the question of the rules. This committee also approved rules that were made by the Rules Board to deal with issues relating to PAJA. You will recall, some of the members might recall, at that stage Halton Cheadle was still involved with the as a advisor to the previous minister, Minister Suti, and he presented, and he was involved in the drafting of the rules. He presented the rules to this committee, and those rules were approved. But the rules contained a provision that they would come into operation on a date determined by the minister, and the reason for that was to allow opportunity to do a number of actions. For example, the training of magistrates that would be involved in matters of this nature. And then subsequent to that, after the rules were published in the Gazette, and then of course not yet put into operation, one of the rules was taken to court on the basis of it being unconstitutional. And that is why, to immediately respond to the first question that the Honourable Jeffrey might raise, why are we only coming with the code now, is that firstly we did further research and we amended the code and we had to consult again, and we did a lot of consultation. And as I say, in the meantime, the rules were taken to, one of the rules was taken to court. And there was discussions, and there was an indication that there might be settlement in this matter, and so we waited, because as suggested by the researcher, we have now included the rules in the code itself, but it is the rules that are still before court on the basis of it being unconstitutional. So eventually we will probably have to wait for the decision of the court, because it might then affect the code and it might then necessitate further amendments depending on what the court decides. The rule that I'm referring to is the rule that makes provision for the disclosure of documents and information. We had the rule indicates that only documents are relevant to the particular matter under discussion should be made available, while the applicants in this particular case feel that all documents should be made available. You will recall it was debated thoroughly by this committee, that particular rule, and explained by Halton Cheadle why we thought it necessary that the rule should be worded in the way that it has been worded. The rules, of course, if they once they are put into operation, will also necessitate amendments to the regulations, but that we can deal with at a later stage, and of course that will also depend on the outcome of the court case. So, Chair, that is the background. The code of conduct has been with us for a number of years, and also with Parliament. We thought it advisable to bring it now, so that at least we can start the process of debating the issues with this committee, and if necessary, bring about further amendments. And, Chair, we will keep you informed of developments as far as the case is concerned, the court case is concerned. We were given to understand that all the papers have been filed, and we are now just waiting for a court date. So when that is going to happen is difficult to say. But as I say, we thought it advisable to start the process at least. If Parliament approves, then we will continue. If the case does not is not finalized by the time Parliament is happy with the code, then we will just have to come back at a later stage to amend the code, depending on the outcome of the court case. So, Chair, that is the background. If there are any questions, that is fine. And Ina will then give a briefing just on the content and those provisions that we changed compared to the previous code that was tabled.
Just one clarification, please, through your chair, to Advocate Redman. You've just said that we cannot amend it, but 10.6 of the PAJA, of course, says the code must, before publication, be approved by Cabinet and Parliament. So, I mean, how do the two things sit together? We must approve it, what, either approve or reject, but we can't amend? Or is it one of those situations?
It's one of those choices. Yeah, you cannot amend the code, and that is an opinion from our state law advisors, and it's the wording of the Act. You can only approve, and if you don't approve, then you disapprove, and then it goes back to the department, and that process then will continue until such time as you approve. And that is why, Chair, that is why really we thought to submit the code to the committee on an informal basis. It was done by way of a letter to the Chair, where we requested that it be done on an informal basis. So, as I said, if we then go to Cabinet, that we can say to Cabinet, this is the code that Parliament is also happy with, and hopefully then when we retable formally then, this committee will approve the code.
Just which court is the rule issue in? A High Court or Constitutional?
North Gauteng High Court. The applicants or the applicant is Lawyers for Human Rights, and the respondent, first respondent, Rules Board, second respondent, the Minister. And I thought the third respondent should have been Parliament, because they approved the rules as published as well.
Because, Chair, I mean, presumably then if the respondents don't win, it probably will go further. So it's not, we're not looking at the thing being resolved. Possibly not looking at the thing being resolved within a short space of time.
Yeah, that is correct. I mean, one cannot anticipate what is going to happen, but that is precisely why we thought that we should at least start this process. And as I indicated, if this committee is comfortable with the rules as now formulated, we can then continue to publish the code as it then reads, and should the judgment go against us, we will then have just to come back just to amend the code. And it's really just a small aspect. It's not a major thing as far as the code itself is concerned, but of course as far as the rules are concerned, it is a big issue.
Presentation, but these, the code does not include reference to the rules. It does not. Okay.
Right. No. I mean, that is one of the points that were made by the researcher. We brought the rules into the code now as well.
Anyone else?
It's not possible to approve it anyway, and if a specific rule is ruled unconstitutional, then that would be not inapplicable. But I mean, to keep the thing that's now 11 years down the line still in abeyance until that's finalized, is it really necessary? I mean, more desirable?
No, not at all. That's why I'm saying I think we should continue with the code as the rules read at this particular point in time. And if necessary, depending on the outcome of the judgment, we can come back to Parliament to amend the code. We think it's important to get the code out in the open as soon as possible. Chair, the other option, of course, is not to refer to the rules in the code. I mean, that is a further option. Our impression was at the previous meeting that the committee supported the view of the researcher that perhaps it would be more appropriate to deal with the rules in the code as well. But that is an option for this committee to consider, whether it wants to do so. Because the rules are there, you know, and the code is there. So,
you don't need to, Mr. Chair. I mean, the rules are the rules as they are now. So if you refer to the rules and the rules change later, it's not going to change the code. The rules are going to change.
I must just mention, Chair, just further mention that we must always remember the rules are not yet in operation. The decision apparently was not to put it into operation pending the outcome of this court case. So we will be having, if we publish the code and if we accept what the Honourable Jeffries has said, that this is might still take some years. If we publish the code, we're publishing a code containing references to rules which are not yet in operation. So,
Mr. Jeffrey. Yeah, look, I think that, I mean, the code is meant to be a guide to administrators to help them make use of the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act. Now, obviously, the rules are a fundamental part of how the Act is implemented. So it seems a bit odd to draft a code, particularly if the whole process takes a long time, and not include the rules in it. I don't know whether I'm not sure why the rules are not in operation. I mean, was there Mr. Rudman spoke about the possibility of a settlement, but otherwise, I mean, once those rules were approved, they could be implemented. It's up to the court to then determine if there's a dispute and an allegation of unconstitutionality or not consistent with the Act. It's for the court to rule. So it seems to me that possibly they didn't come into operation in the hopes that a settlement could be found, but if there's no settlement and it's going to court, maybe that aspect could be looked at and we could get more clarity as to should the rules not come into operation. It's not usual that we hold back legislation that's been passed when there's a legal dispute over it. We usually proceed and then the court, when it makes a ruling, would find the implementation in process. So that would really be one, but I just think it's a bit you've only done a half job if you adopt a code which doesn't make reference to the rules. It's actually, I think, a waste of time, because once the rules come into operation, then it's all got to be redone, because the administrators need, the aim of the guide, the code, is to be able to, for administrators to be able to understand how the law works. This is just an explanation of the law, it's not making law.
Okay.
So it's the Act and the regulations and the rules. Those are the laws relating to PAJA. And the code is a guide to those. That's all. It's not like with the rules we were making law, and that's why it was taken to court, because it has an implication. Whereas nobody's going to go to court on the code, because there's no new law in here. So if we produce a code excluding the rules, we've left out a third of the law, and that's the difficulty. So I think that I would like to know, I mean, not now, obviously, but whether the minister would rethink, given the matter is going to court, rethink the operational, the coming into effect of the rules, and whether we can get a response from that after he's applied his mind to that. But Le Smuts's thing of leaving out the rules, then we've got a third of a guide. I mean, two-thirds of a guide, effectively. And it will have to be redone the moment the rules come into effect, and we should have rules.
Yeah, Chair, thank you. Perhaps I must just also indicate that there were a number of other actions that needed to be taken before the rules could be put into operation. And that basically related to the training of magistrates on the content of the rules. We have trained...
What are you saying, that it will only be able to...
No, I'm not saying... No, I'm just saying that's one of the reasons why... And that's basically one of the reasons why you had a provision in the rules which were very strange to us, that the rules would come into operation on a later date, because normally when the rules are published they come into operation immediately. This was an exception to the rule. And one of the reasons was exactly that, namely the training of magistrates. We have now been informed that a number of magistrates have been trained, but it happened such a long time ago that they need to do to continue with refresher courses and so forth. But they're indicating that they can only do so once the court case has been finalized. But let me just also say, part of the papers and the documents from Lawyers for Human Rights, they specifically requested the minister not to put the rules into operation pending the outcome of the court case. Now, I was not involved in that process, but I just know about that, and I think they made out a good case, or they made out a case why it should not come into operation. But I agree with what the Honourable Zephyr has said. It's not usual for us to wait for court cases, for legislation or anything else, for that matter, to come into operation. But I do not know what all the arguments are in favour of putting into operation or not putting into operation. And as indicated, perhaps at the next meeting we can get the Rules Board, J.B. Skosana, who's been involved in this, and our litigation unit, get them to attend the meeting and explain why this has not happened, why they have not put it into operation.
First, Christine Silkstone, and then... No? Okay. The Honourable Debbie Shepherd.
Sure, one has to just wonder whether this is in fact necessary. I mean, what have they been doing for the last 11 years? Does it make a difference at all anyway? I mean, it's crazy. If they, what have they been doing? But I agree we need to ask the minister to do the rules. But really it does make one wonder whether it's even necessary to do this, if they've been operating fine without it.
So there is a statutory obligation for us to pass this code. And I think the idea is that once the code is actually in operation, it'll start facilitating a proper administrative action decisions.
And furthermore, courts need to be designated by the minister to deal with these matters, and they can only be designated once the magistrates in those courts have been trained. So, you know, things are so dependent on each other that it's very difficult to say what must come first and what must happen.
What is the extent of prejudice suffered by anyone? What is the extent of prejudice suffered by anyone as a result of all of this not being completed?
Thank you. I think from our side the biggest concern is that without the PAJA rules being in operation, litigants can't take judicial review actions to the magistrates' court. That is the one big issue I think that is a concern, and that was I think also the reason why at the last meeting this committee raised the concern about that. And secondly, as Christine indicated, is we are of the view that at least the code will give some practical guidelines to administrators how to read the law and examples of what practical examples of what to do and what to refrain from doing, and for me those are the two basic issues.
Mr. Jeffrey, and then Advocate Holomisa. Advocate Holomisa, sorry.
Now, the fact that the magistrates have not yet been trained and been mandated, therefore, to deal with these matters, have we found people going to the High Court then, as a result? A number of them. And if so, to what extent is that been happening?
I know that there were a lot of case law developed since the introduction or enactment of the PAJA, and there were a number of cases. I'm not sure, except for this one case, whether there were concerns about or a stake being taken to court for the neglect in not putting into operation the act. But yes, there's a lot of case law already in, revolved in terms of PAJA.
In fact, that case law that assisted us in amending the code subsequent to 2009 as well, we studied that case law and we brought about further amendments to the code, which we thought were would be appropriate. But the answer is yes, the people are going to the High Court.
I think we, you know, the rules are basically court rules, which is basically more detail as to, as with the ordinary High Court rules, procedures to be followed. And the PAJA rules are basically dealing with requests for reasons and disclosures and application for judicial review, primarily. So I think without them coming into operation, it does become more difficult for people to take decisions on review. And one of the problems is the issue of reasons, and officials often not wanting to give reasons or not giving adequate reasons. So it's quite important from Batopile principles that those rules are in effect, are operating. And then the code, I mean, just to read the section from the Act, section 10.5, capital A, on page 69. The minister must publish a code of good administrative conduct in order to provide administrators with practical guidelines and information aimed at the promotion of an effective, efficient administration and the achievements of the objectives of the Act. So, the code will assist administrators, the bureaucrats, to implement to perform their functions better. And again, it's necessary. Again, it's part of Batopile.
I fully agree with what JJ has said. Once we finalize the code, we can also really start with the training of and retraining of the magistrates. And once the rules come into operation, then and courts are designated, we can really start using the Act itself.
Regarding the question on training, as I understand it, there has, as Mr. Ratman also said, a lot of magistrates have been trained, but the problem is a lot of them have left the service. So what was problematic as well is that because of the court case, the question has arisen that whether it's economically advisable to keep on training magistrates. They didn't know how long it will take before this matter has been resolved. So a lot of training has started. There is, as indicated, you know, refresher courses given as well. But yet it is difficult for them to make a decision, is, you know, whether to go on and then because of the time lapse, that it will be require a refresher course again.
Every law we passed at that time, around 2000, every single one we wrote in that thing nearly meant that the government had one and was on the kind of constitutional district. That
All right. Maybe you can take us through now.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, if the, as indicated already, the role and the purpose of the code is really to make sure that administrators follow good admin conduct, and the emphasis on good administrative conduct is that they must follow the law. What we try to do is to point out which sections of any kind of legislation is relevant for good admin conduct, and we refer to specifically Section 33, which is also linked to Section 195 of the Constitution, which deals with basic values and principles. Then furthermore, reference in the code is also made to the Act itself, the regulations, and then also the rules that we've discussed just now. Then also the administrator has to make sure that the specific laws which confer upon them certain powers are complied with. So in the code we're trying to make sure that administrators understand there's always two laws that they must follow. The one is PAJA, which is regarded as a general law, which means it doesn't matter whether you're sitting in Home Affairs or Foreign Affairs or Justice, you have to follow PAJA. But in addition, you have to follow the specific act that gives you the power to make a decision, for instance, the Social Assistance Act, which says that you can grant a social give a social grant. Then also what is important, what one of the members referred to, the whole issue of Batho Pele, and what we're trying to say in the code to them is to see this interrelatedness between Section 33 of the Constitution, the right to fair and reasonable administrative action, and of course lawful, and how it unfolds in PAJA, which gives the flesh and the format to Section 33, and then also trying on the code to foster this idea that PAJA is the minimum requirement. So where you have another act like your specific act, to say is if it gives better protection to the person, better procedures, then rather follow that act, the specific act, and not PAJA. So that is why in a number of pages you will see we talk about this relationship between PAJA and the specific law. And as has already mentioned in the committee, the code is there to provide practical guidelines to the administrators and information on how to promote an efficient administration. Chairperson, one of the challenges that we experience is really to see if we know what is in the Act, we know what is in the regulations, we know what is in Section 33 of the Constitution, but it's difficult always to predict how the courts will interpret these provisions. So what we try to do is rather going back on the request of the committee to have a look at all the court cases and see what kind of guidance can we take from these court cases and make it here as practical examples or as best practices. And therefore also the code is there to explain to the administrators and unpack for them what are the requirements in the Act. One of the examples that I can just refer is the Act requires the administrator to give adequate notice. So in the code we're trying to say what does adequate notice mean. Also to say is you must give this person give the person reasons for your decision. Try to explain in the code what does reasons mean. Will it be okay and enough if you only refer to that you didn't comply with section so and so? So we're trying to facilitate the understanding of that. As already indicated, yes, the code is making reference to all the pieces of legislation and the white paper on the transformation, and that we think all the legislation and policies that are applicable to an administrator. Mr. Ratman has already indicated to you that we have incorporated references to the PAJA rules, although they're not in operation. Just one thing that I think is important also when we go through the code is at one, I think it's chapter 5, dealing with reasons, we also had to make adjustments to the code because the rules are amending or are giving direction as to how to deal with reason. And the regulations presently as issued by our minister also deals with that aspect. So we will also have, whenever we put the, you know, what we're going to do with the code, we must also be mindful of that may affect the changes. Because if the PACHA rules are not in operation, it means that we must refer to the regulations as they are now. Okay, on consultation, I can just say is, or before that, it's just, we see this code not as a kind of a code in the sense of a code of conduct, where if the administrator does not comply with the code, that somebody, a third party, can rely on the non-compliance of one of the provisions and say, oh yeah, are we going to take you to court. It's more like a manual, it's a guide and not a proper code, and therefore what we believe is any departure from these guidelines could merely be an indication that the constitution and the requirements of the act have not been complied with. Now, insofar as consultation is concerned, at the first round, the original version of the code, we involved a number of persons in that process, but because of the fact that the code was since 2009 at least in the domain of Parliament, we didn't deem it necessary then to go out for additional comments for amendments to the code. What we did is we did an internal in-depth discussion by our Justice College, who is leading, who are the leaders in the training of PACHA, and then also our constitutional development component, and of course GTZ was very instrumental in proposing changes to the code. We've also tried not only to limit the changes to the issues that were raised by the committee or by the researcher. We also tried to foster the interrelatedness between the different policies and the different pieces of legislation, with the focus on you will have to change your procedures, your systems, so as to make sure that you improve service delivery. So we try also to bring that to the fore. You may have noticed that there's a lot of flow charts, and we hope through the flow charts it's easier for the administrators then to follow the process, and where possible we also have cited a few examples. There's a template letter informing the person about the admin action, and we also paid a little bit of attention to the layout of the code. Now, insofar as the concerns of the parliamentary researcher is concerned, Mr. Ratman highlighted, I think, the most important ones already to you, but also the idea was, or the suggestion was, that we should look at more examples of best practices. What is a little bit problematic for us is because the Act has not been in the code is not yet in the domain of the administrator, and because of the fact that the code needs to be very general, because we're trying to cover a diverse number of administrators, it's very difficult then to give best practices for each and every government department. But fortunately, we still have the cooperation of GTZ, who is assisting the department and Justice College through training programs, and also through these training programs, further example and examples and best practices administrators will be alerted to that. The other thing is, what we try to avoid is to give focus on bad administrative action, which is strictly speaking the flip side of good administrative conduct. So we try to foster and put in our examples in more in a positive note. The question of the PACHA rules we've discussed with and we have discussed, and then of course the annexures we changed the references to, or we referred to new acts and deleted outdated references. So when I take you through the code, with your permission, Chairperson, I will also reflect on where in the documents we've inserted best practices. And then insofar as the code itself is concerned, the preface we also want just to clarify the relationship between Section 33 FAJA, which gives form and detail, and then the fact that it prescribes the minimum standards, and as I indicate, all of which is to make sure that we get to a situation where we improve our service delivery with reference to the Bartopelli principles. And then also, of course, in the preface, we refer to the origin of the code, and the fact at the end of that preface, we want to stress the importance of the code being the fact that the legislature deemed it necessary to ask Cabinet and Parliament to approve the code. The executive summary, you will see there, that's where one place where we try also to strengthen our code, where we not only refer to the rhetoric, shall I say, expression effective service delivery, but to unpack it a little bit, and if you look at the responsiveness, fair, rationality, accountability, these aspects on page 5 of the code, you will see those relate back to what Bartopelli, most of them what Bartopelli entails. And then also in the executive summary, it is just mentioned that PAJA is explained in practical terms how administrators can adhere to the minimum standards that are required in the Act. And then in the executive summary, we just try to unpack a few important concepts that you get in PAJA as well as in and as well as in Section 33. One thing that when you look at the code, you will see there's a lot of emphasis on procedural fairness, both in terms of where it affects the public as well as where it affects individuals. But because when you look at PAJA, you will see that is what the gist of PAJA is. It's about procedural fairness. There's only three other sections that really deals with other issues, and that is Section 6 that deals with what are the grounds of review, but it just says this is the ground of review, and then Section 7 which deals with the rules, and then Section 8 which deals with the remedy. So the focus of PAJA is also on the question of procedural fairness insofar as detail is concerned. Then, as far as Chapter 1 is concerned, there we just try to establish the legal framework for the administrator with reference to the Constitution, and we deemed it necessary to just indicate to the administrator that they must remember we're dealing with a constitutional democracy, we're dealing with a Bill of Rights, and we're also dealing with a situation where all arms of government are responsible and that their actions will be tested against the framework of the Constitution. Reference is then also made to Section 33 of the Constitution. It's basically cited there. And then we also made a reference to Section 195, as we believe that PAJA directly facilitates the realization of Section 195, which deals with the values and principles governing the public administration, and we listed that as well. Then also the Bartopelli, as I explained, we think it's important policy that we need to refer administrators to. And here, once again, if you look at the Bartopelli, the 8 Bartopelli principles, we try to connect administrators to the fact that to realize the Bartopelli principles, they will have to change their systems, their procedures, their attitudes, and their behavior in the public service. And that only if you do that, the emphasis is you will really give effect to the Bartopelli principles. Then on page 9 of the code, we're just reflecting on the promotion of Admin Justice Act. The Act, what does it say? And you will see there in the newly numbered paragraph 1.8, all of that is cited there deals with procedural aspects. not only one of the paragraphs deals with actually the issue of your right to challenge the decision. As I've already explained, that on page 9 of the code, administrators are fully made aware of the general nature of PAJA and that they will always have to read PAJA in conjunction with another act, which we call a specific act. And the fact is that PAJA just tell you how you must exercise your powers and not what your powers are. In chapter 2 of the code, that is on page 11 of the code and at page 7 of the briefing document, it unpacks the different elements of administrative action. Now, it's true, when you read PAJA, you will see there's a lot of definitions and all of them are interrelated and all of them actually boils down to the question of what is an administrative action. You will see on page 11 of the code, which is under the certain sentences underlined, there was this question of who's an administrator, and the question was whether we should not say more about that. Chairperson, we tried to our best of ability to do this. What we've seen is when you look at PAJA, the definition, there is a definition of administrator, but the definition refers you back to another definition, which is organ of state. So that is why we've thought it advisable rather with the when we deal with the element of organ of state to unpack this issue of that you can get a private person if that private person exercises a public function, that private person will, or the action will also be an administrative action. One difficulty that we had is if you look at the case law, the courts warned us against looking at the who. To say the emphasis should never be whether it's the president or cabinet. We should look at the nature of the action, and hence we were a little bit worried to say too much, but we would like to have the views of the committee on that. Then also what we indicated there, the one on page 12 of the code, the one element which that the decision must have a direct external legal effect, bringing the attention of the administrator to the fact that the general rule is that the decision must be final, and if not, then it's not a decision that has a direct external legal effect. And also trying to explain that sometimes you may get in an organization a decision that may affect only people outside, in which case that will be admin action, whereas sometimes you may get a decision about a person within an organization, but that can also constitute an administrative action, and a reference was made to a transfer of a public servant. On the same page, page 12, what we also try to make clear by means of some of the shaded parts there is to make it clear that if you perform an administrative action, you must follow PAJA. Also there to bring to the attention of administrators that a failure to take a decision is also regarded as a decision. So if you're not going to take a decision, then in any event somebody can take you to task for that. There are specific remedies in section 8 for that the court can compel you then to take a decision, or that or other remedies that the court may grant. Then the next few pages we're trying to explain or give examples of different administrative action and how our administrators should look at the different components, the emphasis always be on whether the decision adversely affects rights and whether the decision is final. And on page 14 of the code, what I would like to highlight is also to make administrators aware that decisions have opposite effects on different people, because sometimes you just look at the person who has been rewarded a tender, forgetting about the people who put in tenders but who were unsuccessful. Reference is also made to the exemptions that are in section 1 of PACHA, and also in section 2 of PACHA, where the minister may, by notice in the government gazette, also exempt some administrative actions or vary the requirements. But until now, no exemptions have been granted or no variations have been allowed. I recall there was just one request at some stage, but we dealt with it differently, knowing that we would not like to encourage people to make use of these provisions, because it's only allowed in exceptional circumstances. Then in Chapter 3, we're dealing with lawful admin action, as is in required in Section 33. Now, when you look at Section 6 of the Act, you will see how PACHA also analyze this lawfulness in the sense of that it must be the right person, the delegated part, and that is what we try to capture here, is to alert administrator to the different elements of lawfulness, which for some of us with legal backgrounds is general knowledge, but they administrators may not necessarily know that, and we try to impress on administrators that without authority you cannot do anything. Also to challenge when they want to exercise a power, to make sure that they do have the power, make sure that if it's a delegation, that the authority in the Act allows for that delegation, to make sure that if the Act allows for a delegation and it requires that the decision must be, or the delegation must be in writing, that it is in writing, and yes, so really to not assume that they have authority, but to make sure that they have authority to act. And also then that if there are conditions to the delegation, that the these conditions are met. On page 16 of the code, what we deemed important is, but it was also in the original code, is the question of how do you deal with a specific empowering provision and PACHA, which seems to be in conflict with each other, but they, as I indicated, always be led by what are the minimum requirements, and if the Act gives better protection, follow the other procedures. Then I'm on Chapter 4. Chapter 4 is on page 17 of the Code, and you get it on page 8 of the briefing document. The fair procedures in that chapter, we want to emphasize two things: consultation and bias. Now, insofar as consultation is concerned, also it has a pre-decision element, in the sense of we are explaining to the administrators what are they supposed to do before a decision is made, and then also what are the procedures that need to be followed after the decision has been made. Insofar as bias is concerned, a difficult concept maybe for some administrators to understand. We also refer them to the Act, which includes not only actual bias but also reasonable suspicion of bias, and in this chapter we alert them to what that also means. Then what is important in this chapter is that there is a difference in procedure in terms of PACHA when you take a decision that affects individuals versus when you take a decision that affects members of the public, and all these procedures are explained with reference to a specific examples. I think what is important also is on page 18 of the code, where we made a note to administrators that a juristic person such as a company or a trust or close corporation is also regarded as a person, and this means that fairness must also be observed in that regard. We have an example of there on page 18, and there on the latter part of page 18 of the code, you will see how we try to bring in aspects that we got from different cases that we read. The one issue is that to make it clear that procedural procedural fairness requires flexibility, and make sure is no matter what you do, you may have criteria, but you must always ensure flexibility. And then also, insofar as tenders are concerned, we've seen that there's a lot of case law dealing with tenders. Now, we're not trying to say that this is the only guidance to be given, but from the case law, what seems to be a problem is that often tenders are not considered only because of there was a typo error, where it was clear to administrators that there's a lot of figures, and here at the end, there's just one typo error, maybe a zero missing in an amount, and then they threw it out. So we're trying to say how the courts then look at that and say what will procedural fairness mean, to say call the tenderer and ask him to explain it, not to reject the tender only because one or two copies of a document is omitted, and also very importantly to give persons the opportunity to make oral representations, of course under certain circumstances. What also we inserted there on page 18 is where the administrator relies on a report that is compiled by another person. Well, it's so important that if that is the case, that and if new facts are placed before the decision maker afterwards, that the person affected must be given an opportunity to comment on the new information. We've also seen in the case law that there is a trend towards, even if a decision is not final, but it's a preliminary decision which has serious consequences, the courts have indicated that you need to give that person another opportunity and that you need to follow the procedures in terms of procedural fairness as indicated in PAJA. And then one very important thing, I believe, is the question of a promise you make is a promise you keep. Because often when you draft stuff, you say, I'll come back or I'll give you an opportunity, and sometimes you say that without the seriousness that you will be called to keep that promise, and we think it's important to show that to the administrators. And then there's a few flow charts. You will see this is the first flow chart, but it starts with the whole process, how you look at the admin action, determine whether it is, and check whether you have authority to make the decision, and then to determine whether it's a Section 3 a procedure that needs to be followed, or Section 4 in the case of public, where the public is affected. Chapter 5 is about consultation procedures where an individual is affected, and there you will see is it sets out the two steps that needs to be taken, or the one umbrella one before decision is taken and then after the decision is taken. And what we inserted in the code as well, to ask them to make use of template forms with standard headings which cater for the requirements that is in PAJA. So we've also noted there, inserted a note there to say is how important record management is. You know, record management in the sense of recording the reasons for your decision, even if you haven't been asked to give it, because if you don't record it, you don't recall it. And then also to say is that, but if you don't know where it is, you will not be able to comply with Section 5 of the Act. So this whole issue of proper record management. Then also on page 20, we're trying to unpack adequate notice, and adequate notice, the whole issue being giving enough time for people to respond, giving enough information, one aspect that we believe often is not complied with, and then also give, as I said, enough time, and also just say what is your planned decision. this, in this instance on page 21, also we tried, for instance, where you have an application for the expungement of a criminal record. One of the issues, the requirements may be that you haven't been found guilty within a particular year. So what we try to emphasize there is, if you then get the record of the police and it shows that this person has, notwithstanding his statement that he he wasn't convicted of a later offense, and now you get the record and it appears he does. To make the point here is that is adverse information, and you need to put that before the applicant, to give the applicant an opportunity to explain that it may not be his or her previous conviction. Then, a reasonable opportunity to make presentations. Here it was difficult to put in a specific time frame because it will depend on a number of issues. And here the emphasis is also that you may rely on written representations, but sometimes the hearing may be may be required. And then if oral evidence is given, it may be also sometimes fair to allow the person to be represented by a legal practitioner. This is also an aspect that is dealt with in the Act, and just reference is made to those will be cases where the matter is serious or complex. The clear statement of the admin action, here once again you need to give the affected person enough information in a language that they will understand, plain language, to say this is the decision, and the issue is my application for expungement is not approved because of, and then you know what the reason is. Adequate notice of any right of reveal or appeal, that in the Act that the the Act constitutes a right of procedural review, but also in terms of specific acts you often get a right to of internal appeal, where you, for instance, if it's the refugee officer, the Act creates the opportunity for the applicant to go on higher call, for instance, to the minister. And in the PAJA it's also mentioned that you can't go to the court and launch an application for judicial review unless your remedies have exhausted, unless there are exceptional circumstances, and we're drawing the attention of the administrator to this effect. Of course, it's always better to make use of the internal appeal remedies, because it's not so complicated, it's not money, and it's not the court's time. Then on page 22 of the code, we just refer to the adequate notice of the right to request reasons. That is something that is in the Act, and also inform administrators that they must indicate in their response to the applicant where and to whom a request for reasons must be made, what is the time limit, what is the information that must be provided, and where to get assistance. Once again, there's a note on page 22 to say it's important for administrators to make notes of your reasons for the decision, as I've indicated. Then the additional steps on page 22 of the code refers to the assistance to persons that cannot read or have a difficulty in writing. Persons must sometimes be given an additional opportunity to present information in arguments in their favour, and that is the example that I referred the committee to insofar as the expungement is concerned and where you get contrary information. Yes, that is, and then on page 22, what is important is we make reference to existing fair but different procedures. In PAJA, both insofar as individuals are concerned and the public is concerned, you get a situation that the Act allows a different but fair procedure. Different, they say, is where your Social Assistance Act will say to you what procedure to follow, but what you need to make sure is that you need to compare these procedures insofar as consultation is concerned with the minimum requirements of PAJA, and then make a decision whether it will be fair in regard to what PAJA's requirement is. and this is what we're just giving advice on. And then once again, you get a flow chart on page 24. It's just showing the difference between section 3.2b requirements, which is the procedure prescribed in PAJA, and then the existing FEBA different procedures that I've indicated to the committee. Then chapter 6 is about where the public is affected, and we've inserted in the first paragraph after the new clicks case and just drawn administrators' attention to the issue that some regulations, the making of some regulations may constitute admin action, and if that is the case, all of us must be mindful that we follow section 4 of the Act. Now, in chapter 6, we inform the administrator there are actually 5 procedures that you can follow. It's either notice and comment, the issue of a public inquiry and what it entails, and also gives to administrators some guidance as or factors that they must take into account in making the decision whether it should be noted and comment or we should rather follow the more public inquiry. On page 26, the public inquiry steps are set out, and in this chapter also we alert the administrators that the regulations contain specific requirements on how to go about when you have a public hearing, etc. Yes, that is chapter 6, but it also deals with additional measures to publish the proposed administrative action. I've also already indicated that special measures to people who cannot read or write, it's the same as with for individual affected persons. Also, what is important is when you have a public inquiry and there is a hearing, that there must be a report submitted and what the requirements of the report should be. I think it's important that administrators take note of this. It must be a written report. It must give reasons for why specific action was taken, and there's certain other information that must be contained in the report. On page 28, you will see the procedures that need to be followed if the administrator decides on a notice and comment procedure. And one of the very important issues that needs to be highlighted for administrators is the question that there must be a notice in the Gazette. And secondly, I see you have circled it, any local newspapers, and say you must at least require 30 days. I don't want to say to Mr. Rutman, I don't know whether we have always complied with this, but this is really very serious that administrators must look at. Then the whole issue of public inquiry are dealt with, and the emphasis is also sometimes even if there's a lot of people that are affected, depending on where they are and who they are, you may even follow the Section 3 procedure. Then on page 30 of the code, there's also this note to administrators, which is also new, is to say you must always inform the person about the process that will be followed from where you, especially when you're dealing now with public inquiries, that they know what's coming next. Assist people with completing of forms and allowing them another opportunity to comment if the final decision substantially differs from the proposed decision, something that the courts highlighted as well. And then on page 30, we thought it advisable also insofar as additional steps that administrators must take to emphasize the issue of vulnerable groups such as women and children, and that they are given an opportunity at any kind of meeting to express their views, so really to try and encourage the administrators to elicit the views of women especially and make their views known. Page 31, once again, just a flow chart explaining the public inquiry procedure, the notice and comment procedure. Chapter 7 of the code deals with reasonable and justifiable departures. So what we have in both respects of individual as well as publicly affected persons, you have specific requirements given by the PACHA, but then you can follow another procedure if it's fair but different, but there's also a third option. You may depart from the minimum requirements of PACHA, and this is what Chapter 7 is about, with the emphasis on you can only do it in exceptional cases, and the threshold will always be whether that departure is reasonable and justifiable, which brings us back to Section 36 of the Constitution. We gave two examples there, the issue of when there's a flood and you have to make a quick decision, or where the purpose of that decision will not allow you to consult, and we were talking about the direction to intercept communications. It will not serve any purpose if you tell the criminal you're going to the judge. So those are the kind of examples that we just give. And, that is what Chapter 7 is about. And then a very sound warning to administrators on page 33 that is also new is that administrative convenience is not an adequate reason for sacrificing procedural fairness. So in essence what we say, don't try and use your deviation or your departure powers only because of time. You must really be able to show to the court that you have proper justification. Then Chapter 8 of the Code deals with reasonableness. This is quite tricky, this chapter, because when you look at the law, you will see initially when we started off with the interim constitution, there was a just admin action entrenched right, but with the emphasis on justification. But as things develop, the case law is developed, you see that rationality is coming very strongly, and it's trying to deviate from what reasonableness in the first few cases was meant, or as the explanation there about. So we're just trying also to alert administrator to all these issues, and not really trying to put it in like boxes, say this is rationality, this is this. Then what is also important is that one of the remedies in the grounds of review is the question of error of law, and we try to explain that on page 35, which is really a very difficult issue to explain to administrators, because if you look at the case law, it's not, you can't give proper direction and say in this case it will be an error of law, and it seems as if in any event the courts are also, you know, battling with this aspect. But what we asserted there, but that has nothing to do with error of law, but just to make administrators aware, sometimes in your act you don't have guidelines how to exercise a discretion. And what we're saying to them as a kind of a best practice, if you expect a large number of applications, you must have criteria. But you must make known the criteria to the people up front so that they know what you're looking at. And secondly, you must not apply the guidelines mechanically. You must always check whether the result is a fair result. That is also what's new in this code. And then what we've also seen is the importance of when a report is compiled for a minister, often the ministers, because of time pressures, have to rely on a report from a report summarizing comments, just to make the note, if you do that and you know your minister is going to rely on that, make sure that all the responses are summarized in a complete manner so as you don't leave something out and then the minister is misinformed or ill-advised. Then the last aspect to mention on page 35 is just to say is what are the factors that an administrator must take into account in order to ensure that the decision is reasonable. Then chapter 9 is all about informing the person of the decision. And once again, we emphasize the good practice to say make notes, give the reasons. You may not have been required to do so, but in any event, give it. What you may do is you may prevent by that action, you may prevent potential litigation. Also inform the person or the public of the right to request reasons and where they can get it, who the persons from whom they can get the information. Then on page 37 you will see also that when there was a panel appointed in terms of a public inquiry, which is to highlight the fact that there is a written report to be given and you must give the reasons for any administrative action that is taken or recommended without reasonable delay. Therefore, in this case, you can't wait for a request for reasons, and that is what we want to make clear, and also that the panel report is in terms of the law required to indicate whether or to indicate any minority view. Then, that concludes actually this chapter. The last thing just there is you need to have a concise summary of the report if there was a public hearing, and that, but although it must be concise, it must contain sufficient detail to allow a reader to understand what was the evidence, what's the rationale behind it, what findings were made on what facts, and then also the reasons. Chapter 10 is about giving reasons as well. There you will see that is the first chapter where we've now included the PAJA rules. Also, Chairperson, the approach that we followed in including the PAJA rules is to say administrators are not necessarily lawyers. So we've only in certain circumstances referred them to what the rules say, and also to make them aware of what are the time frames, what to expect, what documents to expect, and also things like that they must remember. You can't say this is the reason, my reason today, and next week you're going to court and you change your reason, because all along we rather try to persuade administrators not to try and deal with the legal proceedings themselves, but rather to obtain legal advice and to deal with the matter in conjunction with the lawyers. So reference is just made to the specific form in terms of the PAJA rule, how you must require reasons, then the time frames, namely 10 days within which you must, the administrator must respond to the request, and that the administrator must either exceed or decline the request for reasons, and if they refuse to do it, always there's the possibility of again being taken to court to force them to give reasons. But another aspect that we've alerted the administrator to, if you decline to give reasons, you must also give reasons for your refusal. So it's a little bit tricky there, and you will be bound by the reasons that you've given. Then on page 39 as well, is we try to indicate to administrator what does it mean to give reasons. We emphasize the fact that your reasons should set out a sound understanding of the law, the findings on facts on which the conclusions are drawn, and the reasoning process leading to the conclusions. And then, of course, information that facilitates the understanding of that information must be attached. And this is also guidance that we got from the case law. Then the adequacy of reasons, as I explained already, you can't just say, and this is what we emphasize to administrators, you can't just say you didn't comply with section 2G14, what you must indicate in what respect you haven't complied. There are grounds for refusing to give reasons. As I said, you can refuse, but then also if you refuse in terms of the act to give reasons, the court may draw the inference that you made their decisions without good reasons, without good cause. So administrators are alerted to that. And then on page 41, reference is made to the time variation of time periods for reasons, whereas in the Act it does say you must request reasons not later than so many days. The Act also allows for variation where the two parties can agree to extend the time period to request reasons, and then also what happens if the administrator fails to undo that. Then there's of course also the possibility of applying to the court, an application to the court. Then the flow chart once again on page 42, just explaining the complete administrative process. Chapter 11 is new in the sense that there was a chapter 11, but this chapter 11 deals solely with the disclosure issue. That is the issue that Mr. Ratman raised, and that is now under severe attack by the applicant in the one court case, where it says that you have 30 days from the date on which you got your reasons to request the administrator to furnish a list of the relevant documents, and you must do that, they must do that on a particular form. Then on the receipt, it's explained to the administrator that the administrator must the decision. Those documents that the administrator is happy that should be sent to the applicant will be sent and be open for inspection, and the ones that the administrator is of the view that he or she has the right to refuse disclosure must also be indicated, and then the administrator is also alerted to the fact that this is about making available information so that the person can exercise his or her right in terms of section 34, and the consequences of failing to disclose is also referred to in this paragraph. In this chapter, it's only a one-page document. The content relates to the PAJA rules. And then chapter 12, I think it's the last chapter. This is the old chapter 11. This is really taking the administrator through the whole process of judicial review. What is it? How to enforce your rights? In other words, referring them to the internal remedies that can be must be exhausted, and that your judicial review process is actually as a last resort. Then your application for judicial review is dealt with, and it's dealt with in terms of the PAJA rule, just saying there must be a notice of motion, there must be an affidavit, and that it should comply with Rule 9 of the PAJA rules. And then once again, we encourage administrators really when they received a notice of motion immediately to obtain legal advice, because of the fact that there are legal technicalities and procedures that they may not be able to follow or fully understand. Then a request also, there's also a request for variation of time periods to bring an application for judicial review. In the Act, provision is made for that, and this is explained to the administrator to the extent that we thought it's necessary. And then on page 46 of the code is a discussion on the grounds on which administrative action can be reviewed. In other words, we're trying to say to them what are the standards that will apply and when the court will look at your decision, with reference to lack of authority, including delegation, what does bias mean, the question of failure to comply with a mandatory and a material procedure, for instance, if the Act requires consultation. The issue of procedural fairness, error and law is also unpacked a little bit there. Then the question of discretionary powers must always be used within the law and for the purpose given, and we give an example what does in that entail in practice. Then the old idea on page 48, which is also new, the question of taking into account relevant information and not irrelevant information, and that administrator must deal with that in a proper way. of course, always the possibility of asking advice. We know that is allowed, and we say to administrators on page 48, you are allowed to ask people advice, but you can't act on instruction. I think that is also from the case law where we saw, especially in the one refugee case, that the person does not, the administrator did not exercise his or her own discretion, but was told by somebody and act on instruction, and that is a caution that we would like to send to administrators. The whole issue of rationality and reasonableness, and we tried here to explain the difference between rationality and reasonableness in the sense that rationality is about giving a decision that is supported by the information that you have before you, the reasons given for your decision, the purpose for which your power was given to you, and the purpose for which the decision was taken. Those of you where reasonableness normally just say what is the impact of the decision. So that is chapter 13 is the good administrative conduct, your practical example that takes you through the whole application process of this must do there and what information came to the fore by the administrator and how he must go back to her and say this is adverse information, what is your side of the story, and even if you don't get a response, to encourage administrators, if it's possible, to go the extra mile, get more information to ensure that you take a proper decision and that your decision is not necessarily taking you to court because you've not given the person another opportunity to submit information to him or her, and just how the letter, you know, more or less what's the information that you must contain, the history of the matter, how did you arrive at the decision, the facts on which the decision is based, all of that you will get in chapter 13. What to do if you're not allowed to give reasons automatically. In the Act, there is an encouragement for administrators to say, to ask our minister by noticing the Gazette to say, is this information that I have are always, it's automatically available, and then you don't have to request it. I must say, I'm not sure whether there is a notice in that regard, but that would have gone a long way in addressing this whole issue of me having to request information, but that is also just explained here. And then how you should end off your information. And then, of course, there is a template, a letter that is attached as annexure, I think, F, to your document, and where we also try to make certain changes having regard to the comments that we receive. And then the rest of the code is only the copies of the legislative framework within which the administrator must work, so as to make sure that they have everything at hand. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you. Thank you. All right, honourable members, questions for clarity, Prof. Dabandam.
Thank you, Chair. Could I obtain some clarity? Does this very, very good code form part of the syllabus of students of administrative law at our law schools?
No. As far as I know, not. But I recently had a look at, and forgive me for my preference, I look at UNISA's study guide for LLB students, also to assist me in updating this. No, but many facets of this is of course contained in that, because we're dealing with admin law here. So it's not as an annexure, you won't get everything here, but many of what is contained is contained in at least UNISA stuff.
Chair, perhaps once the code has been published, universities will take cognizance thereof and they will probably make it part of their curricula.
Yes, it is a. I'm just thinking of a particular decision taken by someone, and as you're taking me through this, I'm coming to a fast conclusion that they've messed up badly. But, well, comments, honourable members?
No one else has left, Mr. Chair. I think, I mean, it looks like a lot of work has gone into this, and I think we need to thank the department for that. And I really would like us to take the earlier suggestion on board about trying to get the minister to approve the rules in the meantime. I mean, since when do we wait for rules to be approved? I mean, we can't wait forever and ever and a day until court cases are finalised and appeals and whatever else before we do this. I mean, it's existing law until it's declared unconstitutional, and I think we really, 11 years later, is now enough.
And I think the important point made by you, Mr. Redden, earlier is that litigants are unable to take decisions on review. That's very important. That's what worries me more than anything else. You know, I'm wondering if someone can't take us to court on this, on that basis.
I mean, that point that you made about the disputed rule or clause or whatever, if you refuse to allow people access to certain documentation, is that a decision also appealable or reviewable, or it should be appealable?
I would have to check. I'm not sure. I don't think it will be part of that, because this process, it's part of the court process, whereas the previous process is part of the administrator's process. You see, the difficulty also came in at, and that's why we have to revise the regulations, because requests for reasons, as the law stands now, are dealt with in terms of regulations. But if the PACHA rules come into operation, they form part of that process. So almost as if it's part of, I know, not discovery of information per se, but that was the reasoning why they tried to bring it to the judicial review process. Because I think it's PACHA that says now that is by year. So it depends on where we stand now, it will be, but I think that the courts may have to look at it differently when the PACHA rules are in place, because it formed part of the process of judicial review.
Just to say, Chair, that I get the drift of the committee about the implementation of the rules, and I will follow that up immediately when I get back to the office. And although I was hoping that the committee would approve the code today, I'm just saying that in jest. Chair, I will then at the next meeting make sure that we give you a proper response to the reasons why there is the view that it should not be put into operation, and then also the other side.
All right. Honourable members, can we take this any further? No.
We need some kind of timeline there.
Yeah. What are we looking at? Next week? No, next week wouldn't be good, Mr. Ryman. We're in Bloemfontein next week. And what are we doing on Tuesday? Legislation. Yeah. So I'm not sure that next week we'll do. We rise when? 15th.
21st. Yeah. 28th,
yeah. Yeah, arise and then come back in October, 10th-ish of October. That's our program model is. So we're looking at the first week in October, Mr. Adler.
That's fine.
Is that okay? Yeah, I think they're looking for, what, half an hour or so? Just for the committee to see.
On the question of the rules, yeah.
So we can slot them in, I would imagine. All right.
I have a question. had
just asked Chair whether the committee is going to consider making this code available for comments at public hearings, or and if so, it might be opportune to do so as soon as possible.
Yes.
But I must say we have consulted fairly widely right at the outset of the process. And as Ina has indicated, this is really just a guide. It's not legislation. There are no new obligations. It's just sort of explaining what...
All right, there are two signals I'm getting. One is I from Christine, and the other is Nay from Advocate Adams. Let me hear both of you. It's fine, Christine.
Chairperson, I don't. It was just explained now that there are no new obligations. First of all, that extensive consultation took place, and if we're going to make it open for the public now, we're going to open a new can of worms. And to what extent are we going to limit different interpretations, and to what extent are we then going to incorporate it as well? I don't think that we should open it for public hearings or.
I think I'd like to think about it a little bit. I hear what Advocate Adams is saying. It's always good to get public input, but it could also then open a can of worms, and then of course it's not officially before us either, which might be another issue. Yeah.
You know, when you do officially table it, that is when we'll be expected to call for public comments. But then how do we explain to the public that whilst we are asking you for your comments, we may not amend? That part is going to be extremely difficult to put across to the public, if you understand the difficulty. Advocate Holomisa, and then Christine again.
First of all, I would imagine that interested public should be in a position to know that we are not in a position to approve. But secondly, I imagine that it's not always imperative that people who make submissions must be invited. They can make submissions in writing, and we consider them if we come to a decision to make it open for them to make submissions. That would be some way of condemning the ones.
All right. Christine is suggesting that maybe we need time to think about that aspect, which we do have. Mr. Redmond?
No, really just wanting to confirm what was said, that really this document contains really the legislation that is in place, and it just helps to assist the administrators on how to do their job. It does not affect the public at all. Chair, but may I just say that if you feel that you should perhaps make it available, that you do so at this stage, in the sense that it is still then a working document, and it's with you informally, but that when you listen to people and you get comments, that you can then indicate to us what amendments you require, so that when we table next time, that it then be a final document. Why not?
I'm not sure if it would be proper for us to be inviting the public, thing that is not really formally before us. It's still within the department, and the department obviously knows some stakeholders who would be interested in this. It's those stakeholders that they may want to directly check if they want to make comments.
I'm reminded, Mr. Rahman, of the Muslim Marriages Bill, which the department is presently seized with. Whole range of people wanted to speak to me about it, and I had to say to all of them, look, we don't have the bill before us, and until then, I mean, it's just it's pointless coming to see me, because they wanted to come and see me. Mm-hmm. We need to explain certain things to you, and I said, to what end? Because you need to speak to the department. And I referred all of them to Mr. Rappin. You know, but that's the difficulty. Yeah, 2000. That's the difficulty, Mr. Rappin.
Yeah. So. It's also different when it's a piece of legislation. This is not a piece of legislation. And we've been debating it for 11 years, for goodness sake.
Sure. All right. Mr. Rappin, ma'am, thank you very much. I know it sounded like it's being difficult listening to you, but I'm not sure that people realize just how important this, both the legislation and the code, are. In time, they will, but, well, we'll see. Yeah. Yes, a hell of a lot of work has gone into it, and we appreciate that. Our gratitude to everyone concerned. We've got nothing else. And I had asked Vonani to just briefly update us on Saturday, our visit to Pretoria and the Magistrates Commission, and as far as is possible, next week's arrangements.
That's fine. Okay, fine. Just to say that members who will be leaving from Cape Town will leave it on Friday. I think it's around about the departure time is 5. And they will be sleeping over at Southern Sun or at Tambo. And Saturday morning around about between 8 and 8:30. We should be leaving because members will be flying from, I think it's Durban, Chairperson and Mr. General of Midtown, and Prof. Nabanab. Yeah, they will join us on Saturday morning, so we'll link up with them at the airport on Saturday morning between 8 and past 8. And there will be 2 shuttles taking us to Pretoria, and we're meeting them at 10 until 12. I'm told that, you know, there might be something, a lunch arranged for the committee there, but I think, you know, maybe it might take us, you know, some few minutes, you know, just to have that lunch. And then we should be heading back to the airport, and most people are coming back on Saturday. I think they'll be, I think their flights are around about 3 o'clock. Yeah, I think that's it.
And next week?
And the Bloemfontein one, I'm told that it's Fazila Mohammed, if I got correctly. It's arranging the transport, but I think from my side, what I'll just have to do is arrange transport for us in Bloemfontein from, you know, the hotel to the airport. I'll be talking to J.B. Skosan and Mr. Rodney Isaacs to try and draft a program for us, but at the moment I think the intention is that the first day we should meet the SEA, and we will discuss the 2 bills that we have before us, 70th Amendment and the Superior Court. There should be a visit as well, maybe to the court itself to see, you know, maybe the structure and, you know, something. Yeah. And then in the afternoon, the intention is to go to the One Stop Child Justice Center. And then the following day should be the High Court and one Magistrate Court around Bloemfontein. I think that should be it for the 2 days.
Okay. David Schaefer.
Can I just ask, I mean, it sounds like it hasn't even been organized with the ACA that we're going to be meeting with them next Thursday. And I mean, what are the chances that they might not be able to meet with us? And then, just to let you know that I will be able to be there on the Friday. But thank you for trying to organize the other one on the Thursday, but I can make it on the Friday. And just what time are we going to be finished on the Friday? What time will we be come back home?
Logistics are very important because They can't just be left hanging.
Okay, no, the first question regarding the SEA. I have seen, you know, some exchanges between Mr. Skosana from the department and the judges at the SEA. So they are aware, I think, of the, yeah, they know very well that the committee is coming, but now all that is left is for us to just maybe link up and draft the proper program for the committee. As to the return flights and stuff like that, at the moment, like I said, you know, I don't have much information, but I'll try and get this for, that for you as well. But our own visit, I mean, if we are meeting the High Court in the morning and then the Magistrate Court in the afternoon, so maybe, I don't know if I can say that, and about 4 or so we should be done with the with our program, I think. Yeah.
Just that if Ms. Muhammad's office phones us and wants to know what time we want to fly back on Friday, we need to know what to tell her. That's my point.
Oh, okay. No, then maybe what I'll do, then I'll just have to speed up the process of finalizing the program so that that can be arranged properly.
Yeah, there's not many flights from Bloom.
We got a circular last week, Mr. Chair, about Parliament of the People, and they said that they are putting, SAA has agreed to put on extra flights, apparently. But they are normally, I mean, I don't know what times or anything like that, so that's why we just need, if we say 5 o'clock on Friday, that should be fine, do you think?
It should be. Right. But you need to check.
Yeah.
Right. I had on your behalf asked Mr. J.B. Skosana to engage with the Justice and Party and the Supreme Court of Appeal, you know, everyone involved, about our visit, and to coordinate so that, you know, we don't arrive there and find Justice and Party sitting in court or not even in Bloemfontein, which is possible. And he's been doing that on our behalf, and he's been liaising with Bonani. Okay, so that's as far as that's concerned. I take it Christine is part of our trip.
Yes.
And she knows that. Okay.
The other thing, Mr. Chair, is that there were two hotels mentioned in the Parliament for the People. I think it was Protea, Bloemfontein, and Southern Sun. So we should ideally all agree to stay at the same one, I would imagine. Otherwise, transport's going to be a problem. Shall we all try for the Southern Sun as the first option?
All right. Anything else, honourable members? If not, thank you very much.